and welcome. My name is Brian Field, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Our speaker today is Dean Sycom. Among his many honors, he was winner of the 213 Oslo Business for Peace honoree, the Nobel Prize for Business, and first ever winner of the United Nations Women's Empowerment Principles Leadership Award for Community Engagement. Dean is a pioneer of social entrepreneurship, owner of Dean's Beans in nearby Orange, Mass. For over 30 years, he's worked tirelessly to help farmers in developing countries earn a fair day's wage for the work they do. He works in Indonesia, Timor, Papua New Guinea, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Peru, Colombia, and Brazil, where he has developed projects with indigenous people to provide them with sustainable sources of income which do not degrade their environment. Dean writes the Java Trekker Journal blog on Dean's Beans website. He describes himself not as a businessman, but a social activist. In fact, Dean has donated his honorarium to the Pangoa Cooperative Women's Loan Fund in the Peruvian Amazon. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dean Sycom.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Linda, and the committee who brought me here to be standing at this podium where Henry David Thoreau and so many others have spoken is, wow, quite an honor. You know, that's gives me big shoes to fill. Fortunately, I wore my big shoes today. I also wanted to start off by making an observation since we're in a place of spirit, and that is that President Obama has said time and again that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. And as much as I respect the president, I actually disagree. I don't believe it does. I believe that the moral arc of the universe bends the way that people are willing to bend it. And so it's not a linear march of justice over time. We certainly know that. We look back over history and it's a genocide, it's a period of peace, it's a period of war. It's not a linear equation. Rather, it's more circular. As the Hopis and the Hindus and many other spiritual paths know, creation and destruction are the seeds within themselves that keep the cycle going. It's not linear. And so for those of us involved in social justice, the only way to avoid burnout is to recognize that it's a constant struggle. And Ralph Nader said it very well a number of years ago when he was running for president, when he said, you can look at the history of social justice and social struggle, and it's always power over people, and then people pushing back. Sometimes the people win and get a respite, sometimes we lose. So it's not a continuing straight line at all. It's a constant struggle, and I've certainly seen that in the years. I've been a social justice advocate since I graduated Williams College in 1976. Yeah. Coffee's the newest iteration of Dean, but I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I'm going to be sharing some of the observations along the way with you. So let me start out by saying that business is the largest engine of activity on our planet, whether you like it or not. I realized that after I saw a cartoon in New Yorker magazine, and it was a cartoon of people protesting. Big protest on the streets, like save the planet, global warming, this and that. And in front of the cartoon were two people sitting at a Starbucks drinking and saying, wow, got to take a break here. And the irony, which was implicit, was, yeah, you know, we're spending our time protesting, but then how we live our lives doesn't necessarily reflect our values and oftentimes reinforces the very systems that we are seeking to change, which Wittgenstein, the great theorist, called legitimation, that by participating in the very system you're trying to change, you end up legitimating it. And I found that out for years when I was working as a lawyer with indigenous peoples, trying to use the court systems, both here in the United States and elsewhere, to acknowledge indigenous rights. And I found that we kept losing. And so I realized that, am I doing anybody a favor by going into these court settings and losing just because we think we're right? Because in our court system, when you lose, you set a precedent for the next people who come along. So in fact, I found that I was actually hindering the very cause I was trying to support and strengthening the very system I was trying to change. That's legitimation. So I've been very conscious about participating in systems that legitimate the systems I'm trying to change. Not easy. The point of it is, business surrounds us all. You can't do anything without it touching business. I can't speak in these microphones without somehow supporting companies that make microphones or wear these clothes or drink this water. Everything is ultimately tied into some set of business. So the question is, if business is such a major force in our lives, whether we know it or not, can anything really change on our planet until business changes its fundamental operating principles? I don't think so. And so what I've dedicated my life to is becoming a businessman who can work to change the system from within. Because I also found out, you know, from my parents, that when my parents said to me, do this, do that, my initial reaction was, I'll do the opposite. It's kind of a kid thing. But how that plays out as an adult is I would lecture people about how to behave or protest or whatever, but until I got into the world of business and modeled what I thought was an appropriate way of being, I don't think I had the impact that I've had since. They're both valid. We need people in all forms of social justice, but I find it rather ironic that I became a businessman because, as I once said on an interview, to me, when I grew up, the businessman was equivalent to the devil, right? That's how I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. And so it's been interesting for me to take that mantle on. And to be honest with you, it's been lonely and hard, and it's not necessarily where I get my greatest succor, but it's my mission. It's how I play out my values. So let me give you just a little bit of background on this, because it's an interesting, long, strange trip that got me here. My background is as a lawyer and an international development worker. I spent 2 years after college roaming around the world working on UN projects and other community development projects throughout Asia mostly. When I got back, I went to law school because I thought law was a great vehicle for social change, because I grew up at the tail end of the Vietnam War, and I saw how lawyers like William Kunstler played such a big role in helping sculpt the changes that brought about the end of the war. Well, that may be true, but I found out that I personally didn't have the constitution to be a good lawyer. That's a law pun. Being a lawyer demands certain behaviors and certain training and certain tolerances that I simply didn't have. So one of the things I share when I lecture to college students is, make sure that not only you're doing what you think you want to do, but do what feels right in who you are. Some people can't go out in the muddy fields where you get Zika virus and dysentery and everything else I've gotten over the years. Some people simply can't do that. But I simply can't work in an office. What's better? It's just about your personal predilection. So I'm better out there, because that's where I'm well suited. While I was in law, though, I started working with indigenous peoples on a host of environmental issues, and that slowly became my path. I was doing anti-nuclear organizing in the late 70s, and I met some indigenous folks who said, if you're interested in the nuclear cycle, you ought to come out to the Black Hills and see where it begins. And that was quite eye-opening for me. And after having that experience, I've never looked back. So I've always been working on environment and indigenous rights at the same time. So in doing that, my career began by fighting the injustices of mostly multinational businesses, both in courts and in the streets. And it was a good career, but largely frustrating. And then one of those marvelously synchronistic moments happened when I was giving a guest lecture at the University of Rhode Island on the causes of deforestation in Brazil. A professor came out of the audience afterwards and said, you know, I have a friend here in Providence who has a coffee shop. He buys coffee from Brazil. He knows how poor the farmers are, and he'd really like to help them, but he doesn't know how. This is in 1988. Will you meet him and talk to him? So I did a little research and soon came to find out that 85% of all coffee farmers are indigenous peoples. They have a very unique set of issues. Not only are they poor and marginalized, but they're also poor and marginalized from their own national systems of economics and culture. So they are truly the bottom of the barrel when it comes to people who have the capacity to raise their own lifestyle and standard. So I did that research, met with the guy, and we quickly realized that in the 1980s, there were no international groups doing development work in any way in the coffee villages. So we formed one. We started Coffee Kids in 1988. It was the first nonprofit development organization in coffee, and it's still around today. Now there are many others, but we were the first. And so I brought my international development and indigenous rights perspective in to the world of coffee. I wasn't really a coffee drinker, and to be honest with you, don't tell anybody, but I'm really not much of one now. Cup in the morning with my wife because it's ritual and it opens my eyes, and maybe something around 11 or when we're doing cupping at the beanery, but that's kind of it. I'm not a fanatic about coffee, but I am a fanatic about justice. And coffee has provided the most incredible vehicle, because within each cup of coffee are every major issue of globalization today, from deforestation, women's rights, war and peace, global economic issues, you name it, it's in that cup. And we have a choice of drinking that cup rather blindly or being aware that our purchase of that product supports the systems behind that cup. Just like I said, business isn't everything. You can't avoid it. So I think you can go crazy trying to restructure your life so that everything you touch is in accordance with your highest values. But you can make a stand where you choose to make a stand. So I thought, I'm going to try it in coffee. Coffee is a very large business. 28 million farmer families around the world are engaged in coffee. Every one of them is in a conflict or post-conflict country. It only takes place, coffee only grows within 30 degrees north and south of the equator. So obviously it's the global south, the developing world, the conflict world. So it's a tough place to raise a family and try to change your life. So I thought, this is going to be a good place to do this work. So Coffee Kids was great. I spent a lot of time traveling, and my role in Coffee Kids was to go to indigenous communities, meet farmers, meet communities, and then start to develop programs that address their developmental needs. My take on it was to do it according to the needs that the farmers expressed. Because at the time, and it's quite frankly still the dominant paradigm in international development, it's kind of top-down, northern-centric. All these big NGOs, which are called bingos in the trade, big NGOs. The bingos come with their own ideas. They come with their own template of programs. And frankly, if you've ever heard of slash and burn agriculture, you know, like the farmer works the field for 3 years, then burns it and goes on and moves on to another field, maybe comes back 10 years later, called Swidden or slash and burn agriculture. Well, it's the same dynamic in international development, slash and burn development. These big NGOs go into a village and they'll come in, whether it's Plan International or CARE or whatever, they come in with a 3-year plan. We're going to have this project with a chicken project or water project or whatever, but it's only going to last for 3 years. Then they move out. So I used to say to the bingos that I'd meet in my travels, well, what happens after those 3 years? What happens to your project? And the universal answer was, I don't know. Why not? Well, we don't go back. Why not? We don't have the money to go back. Why not? Because our donors want to see new projects. So the projects were donor-driven, not development-driven. And I thought, something's wrong with that. But the villages I did go back to that had had these programs, inevitably the program shrivels and dies after the top-down structure and money leaves, because it isn't really about self-sustaining. It's about basically sustaining the development organizations. So it's an interesting dynamic, and I thought we need to change that in our work. So we did, and I'll get to that in a minute. After a number of years, though, I noticed an interesting dynamic. I noticed that the businesses that were buying the coffee in these villages and donating a little bit to us, a pittance to us, to do the development work, weren't changing the way they were behaving. So what was happening? The people in the coffee villages who largely rely for coffee sales for 100% of their annual income, nothing was changing for them. The coffee companies would give us $5,000 to build a little well that four families could get clean water off of, which is really, really good. But the families didn't have any more income. They didn't have other markets. They didn't have other products. Their kids couldn't get educated. So it was more like noblesse oblige. It was more like, we're doing a nice thing for you poor people because we choose to. But it wasn't changing the dynamics of poverty and underdevelopment in the villages. And I thought, this isn't really what I wanted to do. So I wondered what it would look like if it was different. I wondered what it would look like if a company actually paid real money for those beans. Could the company afford to be profitable if it paid more? The industry didn't think so. But could it have an impact on the villagers? Would they be able to make their own developmental decisions? Decide, hey, we're gonna invest in a new roof. We're gonna send our kid to school. That's their choice. If they had more money, could it make a difference? That's one. And could the company be profitable? Because if the company's not profitable, you got a nonprofit. Then nobody's gonna pay attention to you all over again. So that was the first question. The second question is, even though I, as a businessman buying something from the global south, I didn't cause poverty. That's been around for a long time. But I am taking advantage of it. So the question is, could my engagement with those communities be done in a different way that actually assists people to change some of those dynamics in their life? Maybe not all of them, but some of those dynamics in their life. How could that be done differently to really empower a community to go forward on its own terms? Is that even possible? And once again, could the company maintain profitability if it's funding projects or spending a lot of technical energy doing these things? I don't know. It was an experiment. So in 1993, I decided, let's see if this is possible. I'm going to take a chance and become a businessman. I'm going to open up a company that behaves the way I think a business should behave. And let's see what happens. It's an experiment. I may go bust in a year or two. It's just an experiment. Well, that was 23, almost 24 years ago. And every year that Dean's Beans Organic Coffee's been around, we've grown 10%, 5%, whatever. But every single year we've grown. We don't advertise. We don't do much sponsorship of things, really. But we grow because the word gets out and people support us. Well, I think we have a great product and a very reasonable price, but I think people support us because we represent a certain set of values that sing to people. So interestingly enough, our biggest year of growth was 2009, 2010, where we grew 18%. Why? That was during our economic crisis with the banks. I think people were looking for places where they felt maybe there really are some ethics and values here and we can believe what's being said. So it's been a very interesting 20 plus years for us. Well, before I get into the structure of how we do our programs, I want to make some observations from years of being in the trenches. I lecture a lot. I help other people start businesses. So I've learned a lot about what moves businesses and why they're the way they are and why it's so darned hard for businesses to be good corporate citizens, basically. So let me throw a couple of thoughts at you. These are what my daughters call dad theories. The first of them has to do with the movie The Godfather. Everybody seen The Godfather back in the day? Okay, for the younger folks in the crowd, let's talk about Breaking Bad, which is basically a TV series kind of like The Godfather. In both of these shows, you have this guy, and it is a guy, who loves his family, loves his community, but then he puts on his shirt and tie, goes to the office, and murders people, or creates drugs and destroys communities. And you say, well, how is that possible? How can a person who really loves his community and loves his family act like that? And that's really the nub of it. Because in business, when you challenge business people and say, you're doing this awful thing, you know, you're polluting the water, you're doing this, the business people always get very defensive because they don't think of themselves as evil. They don't think of themselves as doing bad things. They know they love their families. They know they're very engaged in their church or their community. But something happens when they put on that tie and jacket and go to that office. And I've spent a lot of time looking at that. I think what it is business is actually every bit a culture as is Judaism, as is Tunisianism, you know, as is Arabic culture. Business is a real live culture. It's not a bunch of people who happen to be doing something. There's a whole bunch of cultural norms in business, and they're overt, but they're also very covert. And in working in business schools, I finally found out, here it is, in the temple of business culture, here's the nub of the problem. What do we learn in business school? And I often give a talk in business schools from Harvard to Antioch called The Myths of Business School. And I'm going to give you the highlights because it's really important to understand this, why good people do bad things, basically, in the name of business. The first thing is one of the major rules we learn in business school is about profit maximization. And in business school, they actually teach that the highest goal of a director or officer of a company is to maximize shareholder profit. And when I ask that at business schools, I say, is that right? All the hands go up. Well, that's not actually the legal, it's certainly not the ethical, but it's not the legal requirement. The legal requirement for a business owner or director is to safeguard shareholder value, to protect and preserve shareholder value. That's not the same as maximizing profit. Shareholder value is what you as a company determine it to be. And these days with B Corps and other arrangements which allow you specifically to say, these are my values, there's a larger space for this to happen. But as I used to argue when B Corps first started to come out, you don't need to be a B Corp to be ethical. You just need to be ethical. And there's nothing preventing any company from saying, these are our ethics and we're not going to veer from them. But that is a cultural change that's going to take a few more generations to really embed. So it's very, very big, and I don't think we fully appreciate how in the business schools that is the acculturation. Now, a lot of business schools are very proud of the fact that they have ethics courses and social responsibility courses. But in every school I've been to, with the exception of Antioch, with every business school I've been to, those, I'll call them commodified. Those courses are commodified to be additions to products that are on the shelf. You know, we've got business law, we've got contracts, we've got ethics. So rather than ethics and social responsibility being an underpinning of the whole curriculum, it is just another offering. So students constantly tell me, well, you know, I go to my ethics course, and they tell me, you know, that we should really be conscious of our impact on the environment. But then I go to my other courses, and they say, pay no attention to that. It's all about profit. Or if you can't measure it, it's non-existent. And although there are great efforts to measure, to quantify what are called non-quantifiable variables, such as healthy environment, healthy community, self-respect, they try to do it by paralleling. Well, you know, how much would you pay for clean air? It's not quite the same thing. So in a matchup between a quantitative thing, we can create 100 jobs, but at the same time, we're destroying the water. Well, you can buy bottled water. The quantitative one wins in our current economic system and also our legalized cost-benefit system. Since Ronald Reagan was president, the cost-benefit analysis has snuck in to become the major focus of decision-making. It's the paradigm we use in government, the required paradigm in deciding whether or not new legislation or administrative laws can, regulations can go in. And that wasn't even here before. So it's sort of like this very interesting place. If you look back, you say, oh, that was the Renaissance. Oh, that was the Dark Ages. Well, I think in 100 years, people are going to look back and say that our time, oh, yeah, that was the time when morality was overtaken by economic quantification. And that's where we are. I don't know what they're going to call it, but it is an era as big to our development as was the Renaissance. More likely, it's like the Dark Ages, but it's one of those kind of big eras. So hopefully the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way. But as I said, it's a struggle. There's no guarantee. It's not a moral arc that bends incessantly towards justice at all. It's a struggle. So in business schools, we also learn that growth is the goal of the business. And growth, to me, is not the goal. Because when people say growth is the goal, they do all sorts of nasty things. Perfect example, General Motors, when Eastern Europe fell from under Soviet domination, General Motors decided it could make a lot more money by opening up car plants in the former East Germany. Why? No environmental regulations. Okay, much lower wage standards. Get around the unions and all that pension stuff. So it was a perfectly logical move if growth was your goal, and GM managed to grow substantially by doing that, but at what cost? So to me, growth is not the goal, it's the outcome. Growth is the outcome of business done well. Totally contrary to what you learn in business school. Another example, Starbucks, a couple years ago, closed 600 stores, fired 5,000 employees. Why? Because they said, we're only closing stores that are not profitable. Well, it makes sense, but I saw the memo. And the memo was, we're going to close stores that are less than 20% after-tax profitability. Now, anybody in business would tell you, 20%, I dream of being 20% profitable. Under that metric, 95% of all companies in the United States would close. More likely, you're 5% after-tax profit, maybe 8. 20% is off the charts. So Starbucks closed perfectly functioning stores. By the way, didn't sell them to the employees. Just fired all those people. So Starbucks closed all those stores simply because they weren't making enough money. They were making good money, but it wasn't enough money. So growth was their mantra, growth and profits, and it resulted in the destruction of a lot of livelihoods. Another one that's very popular these days is scalability. At Stanford, we learned that if it's not scalable, it's not valuable. So we were talking, I was talking with some Stanford professors who I bumped into in Ethiopia, and I was telling them about our well project. We have a revolving loan fund for wells. Co-op borrows the money, builds its own well, has its own water management committee, they run it. Then they pay back penny a pound without interest at harvest. It rotates to the next co-op, and it's a revolving loan fund that keeps finding water in the desert. We call it Miriam's Well, the biblical prophetess who always found water in the desert, great branding. So the Stanford professor said, well, how many people are impacted? We said, well, 3,000 so far. And they said, that has no meaning. There are several hundred thousand people with no water in Ethiopia. And I said, well, tell that to the 3,000 people who've got clean water for the first time in their lives. Tell that to the parents of the kids who can now go to school because they're not struggling with terrible dysentery all the time. Or people who feel they can't pray because they don't have clean water. Their prayers aren't pure. So, you know, quality, quantity, the scalability issue is a really big problem right now in business. Last but not least, I'll speed through this. Marketing. What's the function of marketing? In business schools, you're taught it's to increase sales. It used to be, in the good old days, before Mad Men, that marketing was about honestly representing your product. So now we come to a conundrum. There's a thing in marketing called fluff. Fluff means you're puffing about what your product is, and it's generally pretty harmless. The usual fluff was, our detergent gets clothes 5 times cleaner than the leading brand. That's so crazy. Nobody believes that. It's called marketing fluff, and there's no legal standard for it. That's pretty harmless. However, when your fluff or your puffery is about humans, such as we're helping the farmers get out of poverty, or our relationship with the co-op gives them such benefits that their lives, that's misleading to the point that I think it's actionable as fraud. And yet, it's the standard in the industry. I cannot tell you how many bags I see on the shelves of coffee where if you turn it over, it says, we're beyond organic. What does that mean? We're beyond fair trade. What does that mean? You know, and all these labels are coming out that make these claims that have nothing behind them. It's like all natural, right? In a recent survey, more people said they trusted all natural than trusted certified organic. But all natural has no meaning whatsoever. You can put it on anything. There's no legal meaning for all natural. Meaningless, okay? Certified organic is a whole other thing. It's a 3-year program. It's a very strict program. And I don't know, it's being besieged here in the United States by large corporations. But in the developing world, certified organic has a lot of meaning. And I stand by it. So there's a lot of stuff going on. In the marketing world, I call it 50 shades of green. So the marketers fall on one end or the other of the spectrum and somewhere in the middle about truth-telling about what they're actually doing. Whether you're doing something for climate change, for example, a lot of companies are saying, well, we offset our emissions by tree planting. The deeper you get into those tree planting programs, most of them are bogus. Because, like, for example, there's an organization, Trees for the Future, which I was looking at working with in Ethiopia, and I think they should change their name. It should be Trees in the Future. Because companies take carbon offsets for the money they give the organization, not for the trees. The trees may be planted over the next 5 years, and there's no guarantee they're going to survive. Yet, the company takes the carbon credit. And in our newly economized world, the carbon credit then gets monetized and sold in an international carbon market. It's this totally surreal and fantasized means of making money off air, off nothing. It's totally not real. I've often said to people in these carbon markets, well, what happens if the trees burn down? Do you have to give back the carbon credit? Oh, no, we got the carbon credit. I was like, but it's not true. So there we go, on the scale of 50 shades of green, that's a pretty bogus one. Similarly with packaging, there's actually no standard for biodegradability and compostability. I know because we've spent 5 years trying to develop compostable packaging. We actually have great compostable packaging, but it takes a year and a half to decompose, which is better than 500 years for foil. But it's still a year and a half, even in your home compost. The problem is the only standard out there for biodegradability and composting says it has to biodegrade within, I think it's 6 months. It's like, what's that all about? Well, I found out that Cargill, the largest grain company that's also involved in what they call bioplastics now, got their folks on the panel that makes the rules for these things. It's called ASTME. It's the American Society of Mechanical Engineers and Technical Engineers. Anyway, they set the standards. They're not legal standards. They're sort of industry standards. And Cargill basically set the standard based on their corn-based plastic, which also has plastic in it. So when it decomposes, it doesn't decompose down into hummus and or humus, rather. It could be hummus. I always get those confused. It doesn't decompose into humus and water. It decomposes into small plastic balls of doom, which are actually more damaging to the environment because they get into microorganisms and right up the food chain than if you put a big sheet of plastic in the landfill. So we've got a long way to go there. The problem with this stuff is people get a false sense of what's being done in their name with their money, and worse, that the problem is being cared for. So us consumers say, okay, that's fair trade, that's organic, that's biodegradable. I don't have to worry about that anymore. I can move on to the next issue. When in fact, nothing's really being done. And the problems of the world are not being addressed because it's being allowed to be subsumed under this bogus marketing, you know, by very nice people, right? Very nice people with their behaviors sanctioned by our existing system of business culture and law. So, yeah. How am I doing it differently? What are we doing to address the problem? Well, I constructed Dean's Beans specifically to deal with the major issues in the world of coffee. They are environmental, they are economic, and they are social development issues. So how did we construct our program? On the environmental front, in recognition of the fact that the 10 most heavily used pesticides in coffee are either banned or the most heavily restricted in the United States, and I'm talking about DDT, parathion, malathion, dieldrin, endrin, paraquat, all sorts of good stuff. We can manufacture them here, but we can't use many of them here. We can manufacture them here, but we can only use them with hazmat suits and training and all sorts of stuff. We can manufacture them here, but we can export them there. So the farmers in the developing world, I can't tell you how many bags of DDT I've seen just torn open, laying around in a field, or children with a bucket of DDT scooping it up and throwing it on the plants. Now, my grandfather was a farmer in Wisconsin, and he did the same thing. He once told me that if you use one scoop to kill bugs, two scoops will kill them twice as much. So it's not, you know, it's not limited to poor folks who have no education in the developing world. It's pretty endemic to primary producers everywhere. So yeah, you can use a lot of these pesticides safely if you have hazmat suits, if you have training, if you have disposal techniques, none of which are available. And remember, we're talking largely about indigenous populations. So when I turn that DDT bag over, I see warnings in English, German, and Spanish, which is great, except hardly any of the farmers I know speak those languages, and none of them read them. So the warnings are, they're legal, but they're meaningless in reality. So a point about indigenous people again, in almost every community I work with in Latin America, whether it's Peru, Colombia, Guatemala, the farmers do not speak Spanish. They speak Cachiquel, Quiché, Mam, Tzotzil. They speak their indigenous language, which is generally not a printed language. So needless to say, there's an inhibition to their accessing information on the safety of pesticides right then and there, okay? So we only deal with organics, and we help farmers get trained in organic techniques and get organic certification, which also brings them a premium in the market. So that's important, and we do that everywhere. That's our business model. The name of the company is Dean's Beans Organic Coffee, not Dean's Beans. It could be organic, but we're, or beyond organic coffee. So the second leg of the stool is economic. I'm one of the founders of the fair trade movement here in the United States. Fair trade is a great kind of first attempt for justice in economics. It's got some holes in it, but like all good systems, you just keep working to make it better. And basically, on the farmer's side, it requires the farmers to form democratic cooperatives, which allow farmers for the first time in their lives, many of them, especially women, to participate, one person, one vote, in economic and political issues of their lives. It allows them to get together for getting credit, and more importantly, accessing the market, because if I grow 5 bags of coffee, like a small farmer does, or 10, I can't sell them to someone in North America. You have to sell a container, that's 300 bags of coffee. So I have to sell to middlemen. So I get bupkis, as we say in the Hebrew indigenous language. I get bupkis for my coffee beans, and the middlemen make it up along the way. Under fair trade, when the farmers are in collective co-ops, those 5 bags, 5 bags, 10 bags, 10 bags can become 300 bags, and they can sell direct to Dean. And I can pay them direct. So I'll give you an example. Right now, the world market price is $1.25, I think. The fair trade minimum is $1.91 for organics, so that's already substantial. But serious fair traders, and there are many of them, serious fair traders always pay way more than that minimum fair trade price. So right now we're paying almost $4 a pound for Ethiopian coffee to the farmer cooperative. We paid $3.68 last week for a container of Sumatran, my favorite coffee. Okay, even though the world market price is only $1.91 for fair trade, I don't have to pay more than that. But that's the ethics we work under, as do many of the serious players in the fair trade world. I'm going to have to short circuit all this because there's so much to talk about. The third leg of the stool, which is the one nearest and dearest to my heart, is the development work. So we have a program at Dean's Beans. We don't use NGOs. We don't do that sort of thing, or churches or governments. We work directly with the co-ops to facilitate a discussion that identifies the inhibitions to development and growth at that co-op, in that community. Then we jointly with the farmers create a program to address some of those issues that the farmers themselves are going to manage. And that is radically different than anything in the development world. And I've been doing this for so long, and it blows my mind how hard it is for people to get that, even after 23 years, because it's not what we do in the development world. And I lecture on this at Yale Global Development Conference every year. The program is about empowering the communities to run their own programs. If we have to bring in trainers or managers for a short period of time, we do it all the time. So the women run the women's loan funds. The community runs the water project. They run the Men Overcoming Gender Violence project we have in Rwanda. They run the Eco Water Buffalo projects we have in Sumatra. Every program is different because it's based on the identified needs of the farmers and their skills and ability to manage it. We fund it from the sales of our coffee. So we are still profitable. We can do that. So anyway, the point of it is, what's it all about? It's about change, not charity. What I was talking about with companies in the past is, well, they'll take some money from their profits and give a little back. That's not change. That's charity and maintenance of the system. Real change is not even putting in wells. Real change is when the people you're working with no longer feel like victims, but feel that they have a say in their own destiny. That is the only real social change, and that's the heart of our program. So that's how we're trying to deal with the existing business culture and the inhibitions for business to cross over and participating in making this world a better place. I lecture all the time, everywhere from Oslo to the UN to campfires in Papua New Guinea, seriously, drinking coffee at night, just talking about women's rights in Papua New Guinea. Talk about a tough crowd. Wow. But the point of it is, it's all about change. And I do believe that we just have to keep fighting, because change is not a linear thing. So I'm going to leave it at that, so we have plenty of time for questions. But I want to thank you, because it's really important to me that this kind of message gets out and gets shared. One time I was speaking at a major business conference about values in business. A woman came up to me and she said, "I own a business, and I want it to be values-based like yours." And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, you know, your business is values-based. I mean, you can't do anything that isn't values-based. The question is it the values you want? Does your business reflect your deepest values? That's the inquiry. And there's nothing preventing any of us from going into that place and coming out and making the world a better place and modeling for the next generation. So thank you very, very much. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Dean Sikon.